What's up, everyone? This is the Next Tape Podcast, episode 30, with Mikal and...
And Tanika.
What are we talking about today, Tanika?
Okay, so we're going to be talking about the Canadian legal system.
Uh-huh.
And maybe how it needs to improve a little bit, or maybe not. We'll see kind of where we're at.
All right. Okay. All right. And are you ready for this, Tristan?
Well, we haven't really introduced him yet.
Oh, my bad. Him. Sorry. I apologize. Go ahead.
Okay. So, again, we have Tristan. If you remember, we've had him a couple of episodes previously. So, he's back again, and this is going to be the final one, at least for this year. Maybe we can bring it back again next year, but... This is the final one he's going to be on, but hi, Tristan.
Hi there.
Hey, Tristan.
Once hi, thanks for having me back.
Okay, let's just jump into it. So, our American listeners, or maybe even people here in Canada who don't know how things quite work, we, because of the country, we're a bijural country, which basically just means that we are a common and a civil law system, which is maybe the easier way of saying things, but that's how it is. Right. Matters of private law in Quebec are governed by the civil law, while the common law applies in the other provinces. So that's basically how that means. So I have basically asked Google a question, and we can kind of figure out kind of where we land on it too, is whether or not the Canadian justice system is maybe too lenient, in particular when it comes to more of the violent crimes. So Google has to say, we'll see what everyone else thinks, in every single demographic, in terms of that's been surveyed, a clear majority of respondents said that the Canadian justice system is too generous with bail and too lenient on violent criminals. So,
I haven't been watching news in a while.
Even if you know the basic in terms of like if a violent criminal is given life imprisonment. Life imprisonment does not necessarily mean life. It means you're eligible for parole in 25 years.
Mm.
Whether you get it is another story, but that's kind of one aspect you can think of in comparison to like the States. Life means life in the States.
Yeah.
There is no chance of parole. You're dying in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think from the certainly from my experience of watching the European Court of Human Rights and those European concepts, there is a chunk of legal thought that argues that life without parole is cruel and unusual because it, at the point of sentencing, you know that you are going to be jailed forever, and therefore there's no reason for you to try to rehabilitate, there's no reason for you to try to change, all that kind of thing. Leaving aside the argument about, well, some people obviously should never be let out, the thinking is that even with few exceptions, even if you say at the point of sentencing, okay, you must serve a minimum, let's say 20 years, before even being considered for parole, then at least you know, okay, in 20 years, I can at least apply. I can make an effort to change, or rehabilitation, or that kind of thing. I'm not saying that argument always works, and obviously there are people who will not ever be let out. But there's sort of different legal thoughts on that. But the other thing I was thinking, just because before I came on here, I was looking at CBC, and saw, I don't know if you saw it, but the story, there was a wrongfully convicted New Brunswick man who spent more than 20 years in jail for murder. He was cleared formally in January, and he just died aged 80.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Those are the stories that hurt my heart, honestly.
Yeah, that's the problem with certainly the death penalty, because it is so final.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a wrongful conviction, or a wrongful legal process, a system has to have in it somewhere the capacity to admit that it's wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe not admit. Admit that it's wrong, but also accept that it's wrong, because those are not necessarily the same thing. And act when it is wrong. And not just say, oh yeah, we were wrong, but we're not going to do anything about it. And there's too many cases, far more in the U.S., but there's too many cases.
I was going to mention that,
Yeah.
That's true.
And that's the thing. Like, I'm not necessarily someone who is for the death penalty. I think for me, it's a case-by-case basis, but there are so many times where it's like, humans make a lot of errors, especially when it comes to, you know, potentially someone being wrongfully convicted, whether that is they're just 9 times out of 10 just zeroing in on one person and not looking at the evidence. And once the evidence is able to exonerate that person, yes, you have those cases where they've spent many years in prison and then they come out and they die. And there it is, that was their life. It's horrible. I look at the case of I can't remember their names now, but they were on Netflix. I wish I could remember. Stephen Avery and his nephew. In cases like that too, it's like you have police officers who are able to quote unquote lie in order to get a conviction, and it's like in cases like that too, it's like, no, that's not okay, because here the person who is clearly on the spectrum, like, I could talk about, I mean, Stephen Avery, for me, I'm not sure his nephew 100% didn't do anything, and he's in prison right now, and that's the part that's upsetting. But I'm all over the place when it comes to stuff like that, because human error. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but if you did kill somebody, I don't want to know that you're not going to come back out into the society where I am, where people I care about are. Because that's a part for me where I'm like, I'm not sure. And I am going to talk about something personal as well towards the end. But
yeah, go ahead, Trisha.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I understand, because I often think of particularly Scottish justice, where I am, I think sometimes that it looks lenient for particularly vicious crimes, or the one that I often think of is death by dangerous driving. The maximum sentence for that, I believe, is 5 years over here. That never, in many cases, that doesn't seem right. That's far too low.
It is.
But, you know, Scotland has a different sentencing regime, sentencing guidelines. It is shorter or lighter, maybe, than England, for example, south of the border. Going back to the talking about miscarriages of justice or evidence and that kind of thing, the other big problem is the legal system and whether it is unequal, and whether people have, there was a really good ideas program a few months ago about this, about sort of the unequal access to justice, because justice costs so much to access. You know, can everyone freely or afford to access good legal representation? That can really impact, you know, what kind of what kind of justice you get, whether you are guilty or not, there's got to be an equal access there. And that also has to be equal in access depending on your background. I mean, I'm sure no one in Canada, well, okay, some people might, but generally nobody's going to argue that Indigenous, you know, people from Indigenous nations are equally accessing or fairly the justice system compared to everybody else.
Agreed. To,
yeah.
You know, the white majority or, you know, whatever. And that is, you know, regional, that's localized. All those other aspects figure into it, as well as can you afford a lawyer who's going to do a good job?
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you might end up with a public defender who, 9 times out of 10, sometimes they don't do good jobs. They really don't. Or in the States, too. So, yeah.
So, yeah, I have a question, since you guys are, like, you know, very smart in this area. The wrongfully, do they get compensated, like, from the government?
They would have to sue civilly. That's what would have to happen. And whether or not they're successful when they sue civilly is a totally different thing, because they're going after multiple parties. They could be going after the police. They could be going after, like, their city or town. They could be going after many things. And there have been cases where they're successful. They're not going to get necessarily exactly the amount they're asking for. That's never the case in any case, whether it's something like this or something more what I do. But there are also times where they're not successful. Whether that's the biases of the police or being like, we didn't do anything wrong and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes they just don't get exactly what is owed to them, especially when they've spent 20 plus years in prison and they have to come out. And think of it this way, there could be people going to prison in like the 90s coming out now. Look how much things have changed in 25, 30 years. They have to
adapt.
Yeah. Adapt, and that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
But yeah, that's a separate aspect of rehabilitation for people who are not jailed forever. You know, what services are there, or if any, when somebody is released? And not just, you know, services, but, you know, basic, do you release them and then say, okay, go find a home? You know, and if you've not done any work, that's why Scotland, for example, has moved away from short sentences. So the default for under 25s is that nobody should be jailed for under 12 months. Because there's no point in short sentences, because there's no point, there's no time within that short period to do, say, work on addiction or, you know, accessing mental health services within prison or that kind of thing. So there's a recognition that under 25, there needs to, obviously, if it's a serious sentence, it's going to be longer anyway, but the short sentences don't really work. That's not to say that it doesn't happen. I mean, I have seen, as a court reporter, regular court reporter, I see people come up all the time who keep breaking alternatives to custody, and there really is no choice at a certain point that they have to be jailed. But also that there is a recognition this will not help. And ultimately, and quite frequently, the judge will put in measures so that as soon as they are in theory released, they will return to court and a new package will be put in place where they are. The most common thing is a community payback order. So you are working with, say, social workers under the supervision of social workers for a year, 2 years, that something like that.
Right.
So sometimes these things can marry up between coming out of jail and what comes after. But, you know, that's not universal. There is a requirement in Scotland, if you are homeless, there is an obligation to be housed. That is a requirement of local authorities. So again, somebody would come out of prison, but there would be an obligation to put them somewhere. So
interesting.
Safety nets in theory to catch people when they come out, but that doesn't necessarily mean there won't be immediate, you know, healthy, productive, legal members of society. But in theory, there are some bits that are in place, but there's also loads of things in any justice system that clearly don't work.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, thank you for that. Go ahead.
Okay, so the next thing, which is kind of interesting, actually, when I saw this, because I'm like, huh, that kind of says something, is apparently what the city that has the highest murder rate is Regina, Saskatchewan, which is
in Canada?
Interesting. In Canada.
Oh, okay.
Saskatchewan. Yeah, Saskatchewan. That's what we're focusing on.
Okay.
Is Canada. So, yeah, Regina has the highest, with 2.98 victims per 100,000 population. So, that was in 2022. Oh. So that is pretty nuts.
What is their government doing?
It doesn't That's matter what their government is doing. If you have the government means nothing. Yeah. The government is no different than the government here in Ontario. We all have the same federal laws.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's going to be different provincial, but slightly, right? It's not going to be that crazy different than the rest of the country.
Right.
It has nothing to do with that, though. Mm. It has to do with the fact that there are some crazy people in Saskatchewan who think it's okay to hurt people. That's all this comes down to. What does need to be addressed, though, is what changes, what needs to be done so that's not the case anymore. That's the thing that I think needs to be kind of figured out. What that is, I don't know. I don't live in Saskatchewan, never been to Saskatchewan, so I don't know. But it's I just found that very interesting. I actually was not expecting it to be in Saskatchewan the highest, but that's the case. So I'm like, okay.
I think the problem with those statistics is it's easy to, I mean, there would be more murders obviously or violent crime in Vancouver or Toronto.
Yes.
Overall, but because Saskatchewan is a smaller population, you know, that's the problem with statistics is
that's true.
The rate per 100,000 or whatever, however it's calculated, can look worse than it actually is.
Yeah.
That's not to downplay any of the individual ones, but it's also not having done for my podcast a particular murder in Florida. That was one of 80 something that year in the city of Jacksonville. So obviously a high number for one city. But each one would be different and individual, and the causes of it would be different, and the circumstances. So sometimes it's really difficult to come up with a reason why they are happening or a solution to limit it. And that's, you know, there's a particular problem in London and in England with knife crime. That is an extremely high problem amongst young people. And actually, I think Saskatchewan has had similar stats with knife crime before. But so you can recognize, okay, there is a particular problem with young people carrying knives, but how you tackle that is, you know, down south it has been generally treated as a justice thing, so you give harsher sentences, for example, whereas in Glasgow, in Scotland, there is a genuine approach to treat it as a public health issue. And so then you have multiple different agencies and sectors of government and public life that are tackling it as a health crisis. And then all the things that feed into why somebody would carry knives, violence with knives, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's difficult to come up with universal explanations for crime or universal responses to it. There's plenty of people, we all know how common it is, particularly for right-wing politicians, to call for tough on crime, jail them longer, jail them harsher, whatever. It's a really easy catch-all response, but doesn't tackle anything and doesn't prevent anything. Because ultimately, surely the point is to prevent a crime before it happens.
Yeah.
So, just tackling the response after somebody has been killed, for example, isn't going to prevent anything.
Yeah, that's true.
I really don't think in the heat of the moment, nobody thinks, oh, I'm about to kill this person. Oh, and I might get executed someday.
Yeah.
I really don't think that happens. I don't think that goes through people's minds.
I mean, no. I could argue that there are definitely people who think I am going to kill somebody today, but they are not thinking about the repercussions of that choice.
Yeah. So, what are the situations for people to start, doing violence in Saskatchewan? Like, is it due to financial issues or divorce or relationships or situation between a family?
It could be all of the above.
Okay.
That's the thing. It could be all of the above.
Okay.
It could be because of financial, and that's where that's the resorting to. It could be gang violence or anything like that. It could be something like that. It could be domestic violence. I think that's what you're trying to get at. It could be that. It could be all of the above.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
I didn't dig into, the different types of crimes happening in Saskatchewan and why it's so high. But I would say that no different than any other province or any other country really is that we could be dealing with the same types of crimes that in Saskatchewan, no different than anywhere else. It's at a higher rate. That's maybe the only difference, but I don't know, because I didn't dig into the statistics as to why that is. Yeah.
Okay. All right. It's all good. I just wanted to know because that could be the root of the issue.
And again, though.
Once again,
even if you figure out what those things are,
yeah,
you can put all the changes in that you can. Sure. Mm. But it also has to come from the changes have to come from the people who are committing said crimes, and people tend to not want to change or have trouble with change or whatever, because again, if you're dealing with someone who, for example, if it is more of a domestic violence type situation, someone trying to leave and get out, and that's the most dangerous part for any person who's dealing with domestic violence, that partner who is committing the violence has most likely done this before, but may not necessarily killed someone before, but has done this to intimate partner in the past. It's not just a one-time thing, so it's really, I'm just at the part of, it's really hard to change humans. I am one. I don't like change either. So it's like we're very stuck in our ways. It's really hard to change that.
The other part of that, though, is that a lot of people, I'm not saying they can't change, but it's not as easy as, if somebody has if somebody commits a crime while drunk, for example, it's not a, as I hear defense lawyers say, it's not an excuse, but it's an explanation. So it's obviously a context for when they committed crime, but if they're an alcoholic, that's not something that you can just immediately switch off. And then there's people who have very complex multi-generational trauma
that oh, yeah.
feeds into something that, yes, there's individual choice and individual actions, but the context they're living in, whether that's poverty, whether that's addiction, whether that is observing, say, family violence, you know, growing up or that kind of thing, there's multiple different things that can have impacts. And then when you also have, you know, a complete lack of mental health services to tackle those issues, whether somebody ends up committing a crime or not, you know, you're not really contributing to avoiding the consequences of intergenerational trauma mm-hmm. or addiction or any of those other things. So yeah, it's complicated because again, there's that response, usually right wing, that says, or its particular rhetorical response, we need to be tough on crime. It's up to the individual. It's their choice, blah, blah, blah. Because that avoids having to tackle any of the more complex things that lead into crime, addiction, trauma, that kind of thing, or mental health services. Nobody is going to invest in mental health services to the extent that is needed yeah. in any country, clearly.
Yeah.
So if you're just going to put that to the side and just blame the individual, okay, well, then that leads to a certain set of responses to fixing the justice system or changing it. And right. there's a lot of people within the justice system that are perfectly happy for it to continue. You know, it's largely been the same, the way it is for decades, centuries. You know, it's not really changed that much.
Yeah. I agree.
So it was a bit of a rant.
No, I mean, and again, but to kind of go on the mental health aspect of things too. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, me and my mom are kind of slowly going through the Fear Thy Neighbor episodes, and we actually just finished watching one yesterday. And it scarred me because we watched it like right up before we went to bed. I'm like, okay, great, let's go to bed now, yay. And it was a case of a person who, you know, two neighbors, one of them was fighting in Desert Storm, he had PTSD and the whole nine yards. And I mean, he made the choice to stop taking his medication, which is probably not a great idea. We'll just fast forward to the end. He ultimately, because again, Fear the Neighbor, someone's getting killed, ultimately killed the other neighbor brutally. And when I mean brutally, I mean the episode name was called Head in an Oven. So you can use your imagination. It was brutal crime. Actually, probably one that I'm like, that was a rough one. Because, I mean, they're all rough, but that was a rough one. And, I mean, he claims it was an accident and all this, but, I mean, come on. But as much as I'm, like, on one hand, throw the book at him, because, I mean, like, this should never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if he was taking his medication still, it wouldn't have. We'll never know. But on the other hand, I'm like, but he is dealing with a mental illness, and he fought in Desert Storm. God only knows the things that he saw. I mean, I don't think he was ever really vocal about it. And the resources for the army or anyone, Marines or whatever, is not there. They kind of just say, yeah, please help your country. And then when you're done helping your country, well, you're left on your own to kind of figure it out. Whether it's employment or housing or your mental health, there's nothing. It's like you're just kind of left and floating in the wind, figuring it out. And that's what's also sad. It's sad that this poor man lost his life in the way he did. But it was also really horrible that this person just didn't have the resources that were maybe necessary for him. You could tell he was getting triggered by just everyday sounds. This person driving up into his driveway would trigger him. The sound, because they were renovating both their homes, the sound of, you know, construction would trigger him. It's in cases like that, it's like, well, what can you do? There's so much you can do to hopefully maybe prevent something like that from happening. But anyway, that was my rant.
But that's been the case for decades. That you know, people coming back from the First World War, the Second World War, there was almost no support. In some cases less than support.
Oh yeah.
And that's, you know, if you're not doing, if you have never been interested in, sorry, I'll rephrase that. If you are only interested in using your people, using your population as cannon fodder or as, you know, to fight your wars or whatever, and nothing beyond that, then that's entirely in line with just, oh yeah, I'm going to blame you for whatever you do when you get back. It's turning people into a number, turning them into an abstract that you don't need to care about, you don't need to provide services to, you don't need to support. So, you know, there's a societal issue of looking at crime or looking at the justice system as not people. And I don't get me wrong, there are some crimes that are not very human. But the hardest,
this particular crime was definitely not human.
Yeah.
But
the problem is that it was a person who did it. So it's easy to respond to say, you know, that person's not human. They're just evil, whatever. The problem is confronting the fact that actually it was a human being that was capable of that. Yeah. And how do you respond to that, either after the fact, or do you think systemically, okay, what can we do to prevent that? There is plenty of evidence that you can't just send people off to war and they come back and everything's perfect and, you know, sunshine and rainbows. And yet no one continues to work to fix that or to work on support. I mean, it's hilarious watching Donald Trump, for example, go on critique the Democrats or Biden for not supporting veterans when they come home, when he was even worse.
Exactly. I mean, you know? My guy. Like, I can't. Oh, man, I can't with Trump. It just, the man doesn't think before he speaks. That's always been the case.
Yeah.
Even before he was president, he just speaks and doesn't actually let the words process in his head. So, like normal people do. But yeah, I mean, in this particular case, you're right. It is a person who's committing it. And how? Because, I mean, again, it wasn't so much the fact that the murder itself, if true, was an accident, I guess. They were fighting, like sometimes men do, and it just went too far. But it was everything following that was like, what in the world? And it's like a switch just went off. And he was able to do, like, you're not thinking clearly if you're thinking, let me do XYZ to try and stop this body from being identified, when it's the person's home and he's missing. And here's this body in the home. Like, he wasn't really thinking ahead about that, his decisions. Because it is, to me, I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course they're going to identify him. It's his home. And the homeowner is missing. Like, come on. But we do have to remember it is people who commit these crimes. And I am for rehabilitation in certain cases. It just really depend. I feel for him because it's like he didn't have the support that he needed as a person who fought in the army and So I feel for him, but I also then feel for the victim's family, especially his mother, who both her children had died, different circumstances, and she had no one. He was it. It was the only thing left for her to have support, and that was taken from her. So it goes both ways for me, but it just depends. But we are about to end off on this section, so Tristan is going to be leaving us early again. But Tristan, thank you for coming on and having this discussion with us, and hopefully we can have you in a future episode. I would love to have you in a future episode.
Yeah, definitely.
I've enjoyed our chats, and excuse me if I sometimes get into rant mode, but
it's okay, it's all good. This is what this podcast is all about. So
Brandon,
having conversations. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, thank you. And yeah, we'll definitely have you on a future episode. We have four principles in terms of the sentencing in Canada.
Okay.
So those principles are denunciation, deterrence, separation of offenders from society, and rehabilitation of offenders, acknowledgement of any of and reparations for the harm they have done. So those are kind of the things that they kind of focus on when it comes to sentencing here in Canada. And as we've kind of discussed already at length in this episode and in previous episodes, life sentence in Canada is 25 years to life. And that basically means that after 25 years, an offender has the right to get parole. They'll have to apply for parole, and they'll have to go through those channels. It doesn't necessarily mean they'll get parole, but it just means that they have the right to do that. So the issue that I have too with this in particular is the fact that when an offender is able to apply for parole, you're not only trying to get parole, but you're also putting the family of the victim or victims through the hell of having to continuously have this hold up their life. Because 9 times out of 10, they're going to the parole hearings and saying, please do not release this person into society. So they're constantly having to relive that. Now,
that's crazy.
Yeah, but that's what happens. It happens here, obviously, because that's our laws. It happens in the States, especially if they are up for parole. If they are not, then they're not. Of course, a person can appeal their sentencing in the States, but eventually those appeals run out, and you just gotta shut up and sit there, right?
But that's
basically what happens, and they need to do that, or they feel like they need to do that in order to make sure this person never gets out again, and that their family member or loved one didn't die in vain. And that's, so we will have examples of people who committed pretty atrocious crimes who are free currently, so we'll go through those. There might be some you might recognize, Mikhail, especially one of them, because we have actually talked about one of them. And
we'll get there, and then also, like I said before, we
ended with Tristan, that I do have a personal thing here too, that I never actually, I mean, I knew they caught the person and everything, and I'll get into it once we get to it, but I didn't realize what they were sentenced with and ultimately what that means. And I'm just like, are you kidding? I cried because I never looked at it. I'll get to it, but I never looked into it until I was researching this, and I'm like, oh God. So there's also that aspect of it too, where it's just like, come on, and we'll get to it. But yeah, it's just, it's hard on the families and the loved ones of the victims who have to continuously go through this.
Yeah.
Why can't we get rid of, because life isn't life. Life is 25 years to life.
Oh, yeah.
In our country.
Yeah, that's that you're playing with some, playing with someone's life when it's very dangerous in terms of when it comes to a person's life, because like, I'm just wowed.
Sorry. Yeah. So when it comes to parole eligibility and the potential release, may be determined through various legal mechanisms, as I kind of said, including something called the Faint Hope Clause, which I never knew. I feel like I've heard of it before, but it couldn't quite dawn on me what that means. So if you're out there too and wondering, what is that? Here's what it is. The Faint Hope Clause offers an inmate serving a life sentence, which again, as we said, not a life sentence, for murder or high treason, the possibility to apply to have his or her parole inadmissibility date reviewed after serving at least 15 years.
Wow.
And I feel, I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like that's what happened with Paul Bernardo. It wasn't 25, it was 15. Or roughly around that, because I don't think it was 25. I could be wrong. I can't remember. But I feel like he's been eligible. So I think he went to prison, he was sentenced anyways, in mid-90s. And he's been eligible for parole for at least close to 10 years now. Which doesn't make... The math is not mapping for me.
Yeah,
that's what I'm getting at.
That's crazy, yeah.
And he doesn't deserve it. That's what I mean. People like him do not deserve to ever breathe the same air I'm breathing. Nope. Ever. So.
What do you think of the people that believe that he deserves to be out?
You need to look inward. That's what I think. You need to look inward because there's something not clicking. Because this is a person who, let's not forget, we talked about him. His atrocities don't start with murder. It starts with rape. He was raping women for a very long time. From what, I think it was 88 till about, or maybe before, I think about 88 till about 90, 91. That is a very long time for women to be in fear around the, I think it was Scarborough U of T campus. There's a lot of people to be fearful of the unknown, this ghost in the night, and be raped potentially by him, or, and also not just that, beaten, okay? Mm. And then he went to murder. Not, and it started with his fiance, soon to be wife's sister. And I guarantee you, it was then that it got triggered for him of, I can get away with this. Now, eventually, obviously, he gets caught. But that meant three women lost their lives. Three young women lost their lives. That man never deserves to come out. Ever.
I do agree with 100%. Someone like that doesn't not.
They don't change.
They don't change at all.
They don't change.
And people out there thinking that that he deserves a second chance. People change within 15, 20, 25 years, etc. People like that, I don't think deserves to be out. I feel like once a murderer, always a murderer.
Yeah. Not only that, yes, he's a murderer, but he's a murderer of underage girls.
Yes.
I'm sorry, put him under the fucking jail and leave him there. He should never come out. I mean, I'm sorry, he just this is cases like Paul Bernardo where I'm like, yeah, let's put him not only let's bring back the death penalty for someone like Paul Bernardo. And you know what? Maybe even the electric chair. Let's bring that back because I don't give a shit about people who hurt kids. I don't care.
When was the last time Canada ever did the electric chair? Because I don't remember any of them happening in Canada. Mostly in the United States, though.
We did have the death penalty here, though. We did.
Yeah, I know.
It was... Oh, God. I can't remember the exact year. Because I actually went to... In school, I actually went to... it's now a hotel, but it was the Carleton County Jail in Ottawa. And they had you could actually see the gallows because it's haunted. But you could actually see the gallows, where we didn't actually go to it, but you could see it from inside. And we had it, but I think the last one would have been in like the 1800s. But I just don't know exactly if it was like early 1800s or late 1800s. Like, I'm not sure. But we actually didn't kill a lot of people at that particular prison anyways.
Late.
There was a lot of death in that particular prison, but it wasn't just because of people actually carrying out the death penalty. It was just also just the conditions of that prison.
So I did some research on Google.
Okay.
It said, how many people have died from the death penalty in Canada? So 710 people.
That's not crazy, actually.
Yeah.
That's basically, think of it like, how many provinces do we have? That's not bad. My math is not my math, but that's not bad.
Yeah.
In comparison, because like, again, you have the states and certain, the states and in certain states that still have it and are not afraid to use it. So, especially Texas, they're not afraid to use the death penalty. And yeah, I mean, they're like California. I'm not sure if they actually got rid of the death penalty in general now. They, even people who were on death row, like they have been on death row for many men. Like, I don't think California is quick to necessarily carry out someone's death sentence. But I feel like they got rid of it because I know a few different inmates have their sentences commuted down to life. But I can't remember.
In 2022, 18 death row inmates were executed in the United States.
Wow.
18, yeah.
That's it. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's crazy.
We won't get into the death penalty situation here because I'm telling you, I'm not necessarily a person for, or even necessarily a person against. Like I definitely used to be against, but I've definitely changed my views, but very slightly. It just depends on the person.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. What type of person would it take to get that?
It depends on the crime.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Yeah.
Honestly, there is, for me, when it comes to the death penalty, there's no rhyme or reason as to what constitutes a death penalty case, because there are cases where I'm like, okay, yeah, that makes sense that would be considered a death penalty, but then there's other cases where I'm like, really? Why? So there, think of it in the sense of it is just, usually it's those crimes that are just really horrific, and 9 times out of 10 are the ones that are considered first degree murders too. Because second degree murder case is most likely not going to get death, but it's just like, it's over and beyond. But there are some cases where it's like, that case is worse and it's not on death penalty, it's not death penalty case. Yeah, this one is not that bad, but it's a death penalty case. So it's, I can't tell you, because I just kind of observe a case as like, I don't get it. Why? So it's, I think it just depends.
And so kind
of, yeah.
Like, do you feel like some death penalties were racially like motivated? Like,
oh, in the past? 100%. 100%. Yeah, we did talk about one. No, it wasn't Rodney. What was his name? I can't remember his name right now, but it was a case of a guy. They were in, it's a Texas case, and he was accused of killing his girlfriend, who he was a black man. She was a white woman, and she was engaged to another man who was a cop, a white man as well, and he was a cop. And they said that he killed her, he raped her, and he killed her because they found his semen in her when they did the autopsy. But it was like, but they had sex 3 days before. He 100% was honest about that and said, we had sex like 3 days ago. So chances are, you're not using protection. It's still in there. And because, you know, semen lives for 3 to 5 days. And it's like, it was still in there. We had sex. That's all that happened, though. And they still charged him for murder and capital at that. So he was on death row. But it's like, are we doing this based on the crime?
Right.
Or are we doing this because based on his, the color of his skin?
Skin.
And chances are, he did not kill her. I am a proponent of he did not kill her. Mm. He didn't do it. It was the fiance who did it, because he has had run-ins with, he's no longer a cop. He's had issues with keeping his hands to himself, and he's in many cases, not just even intimate partner violence, but in just in general, he's a hothead. But we think the guy who seems like a gentle giant, because to me, I think he's like a gentle giant, is the one who killed the girlfriend. Okay. All right.
Okay, I see.
And this was in the 90s, too. So we're talking early 90s Texas. So, yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
But.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the cases of people who were released and after an egregious crime and all that. So we're going to go into that now. We have Craig Monroe. Monroe was robbing a Toronto restaurant in 1980 when he shot Constable Michael Sweet, who was an officer attempting to intervene the robbery. Over a 90-minute standoff happened, and while this was happening, Monroe held off any attempt to secure medical care for the seriously wounded officer. So he was still alive. And he was like, nope, ain't no one coming and rescuing this person. That's an intentional act. I'm sorry, that just is. So the officer, Michael Sweet, bled to death and was pleading for his life. And while he was doing that, Monroe was mocking him, saying that he would never see his three daughters again. That's fucking disgusting. Wow. So the episode would cause another officer at the scene, Sergeant Eddie Adamson, to take his own life in 2005. So 25 years later, he ends up killing himself after all of this happened. Witnessing. So this happened in 1980. In 2005, another officer who clearly witnessed all of this committed suicide or unalived himself. Yeah.
Wow.
So in 2010, despite being deemed a moderate risk to reoffend, okay, he's on a low risk, it's moderate, Monroe was granted unescorted passes from a BC minimum security prison. Those were revoked, though, in 2012 when he tested positive for cocaine and was found to be consorting with prostitutes, although he is able to reapply for parole every 2 years. Like, come on. Are you kidding me? Why was he ever given unescorted passes initially to begin with? He did kill somebody, even though his intent in that moment was not to kill anybody. Right. He did ultimately kill somebody. and he's just allowed to go Roman and get cocaine and have sex. Sorry, sir. The minute you decide to kill somebody, you no longer get the right to have sex ever. Okay? Sex is a privilege.
Yeah.
And you've lost it. Like,
yeah.
It's just, I don't understand. Don't understand.
I'm a loss of words. I don't know what to say about that because, like, I don't know. Continue.
Next person, Patrick Kelly. So, a former RCMP drug squad officer, Patrick Kelly, murdered his wife. Okay, an RCMP officer, y'all, killed his wife. Her name was Jeanette in 1984. Trigger. By throwing her off the balcony of their 17th floor apartment. And this was in Toronto.
Wow.
Yep. Kelly has never admitted to this murder. Basically, I guess he's trying to say, oh, she jumped. They can literally test whether or not a person jumps or is pushed.
Okay.
But tell yourself that. But again, this was in 1984. Things have obviously evolved. Yeah, so he never admitted to the murder, claiming that his wife simply tripped and fell out the window. That sounds about right. Nevertheless, he has repeatedly been granted day and full parole since 2004. Every time, he has quickly violated parole terms by pursuing multiple romantic relationships with women who are completely unaware of his criminal past. Again, I'm going to say back to what I said before. You murder somebody, you're not allowed to have sex anymore. I'm sorry. Get it cut off? Can we just do that?
So he's never been like sentenced to a certain... How many years?
He was sentenced. He was... I don't think it actually says because we're kind of more talking about the issue here, right?
Yeah.
But he would have been sentenced, absolutely.
Okay.
Because he was ended up being given day parole at some point. So he was sentenced. But because of our system, our justice system, he was able to get parole after potentially either 15 years or 25 years of pending. I'm going to say, based on the timing of all of this, I'm going to say 15 years. He was able to start getting parole. And he just kept violating it. So that's the thing. When is enough enough? If they're continuously going to keep violating the parole terms, when is enough enough when you just say, I'm done with you? You know what I mean? That's the part for me that I'm just like, even the states, right? If you violate your parole terms, eventually enough's enough. So what is that for us in Canada? When is enough enough? And I don't know. It doesn't sound like that ever comes. Death.
Yeah, no.
When the person finally dies is when it's enough. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, those two incidents, are people already murdered already, basically, for that to happen?
No, I mean, like, the person who did the crime is right. When they die is when it's like, okay, well, we're done with that person now. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay.
So another person, Andy Bruce. Bruce was given a life sentence in 1970. Again, life does not mean life. For shooting dead a young woman in front of her 7-year-old daughter. So he shot and killed a woman in front of her daughter. Seven.
Sorry.
She was 7 years. He shot this woman in front of her 7-year-old daughter.
Oh, wow.
Reportedly over an ounce of heroin. I mean, I don't know much about much, but I feel like that's not a lot.
That's scummy. Even gangsters don't do that. Like, they have a code. They have a code that don't shoot somebody around with children. Well,
I don't think they necessarily have the code to not shoot someone in front of a child. They just won't shoot the child.
Yeah, I don't.
That's the code.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No children, no dogs, no animals. That's their code.
Yeah, but I don't think they care necessarily shooting a person in front of that person.
Yeah.
It's or animal. It's they just won't shoot the child. Right.
Yeah.
So even before that, though, Bruce had a lengthy rap sheet that included 2 sex attacks on strangers. Okay, this guy's an asshole. In 1975, Bruce was one of the ringleaders of a hostage taking an escape attempt at New Westminster's BC Penitentiary that killed 32-year-old social worker Mary Steinhauser, reportedly as she was being used by Bruce as a human shield. So this fucker takes a woman and says, "You'll protect me. Are you kidding me? Throw a pair, sir. Actually, don't, because you two are never allowed to have sex again." Despite all of this, Bruce was granted full parole in 2010. He was arrested again in 2016 after he was found masturbating at a bus stop and threatening passerbys with a can of pepper spray.
What?
Mm-hmm. So you have...
What's wrong with this man?
You probably have your micro penis out in the world masturbating in front of people. And because, I don't know, they're... I'd be sick. Because I don't need to see your micro penis or whatever. I don't know. And you're just have it out there. And then you're going to start, like, telling people you're going to attack them with a can of pepper spray? He's clearly mentally ill, okay? Because, I mean, I feel like...
Yeah, he needs to check into a hospital or a mental health.
I mean, maybe not. There are some men out there who really love their dicks and think, you know what? The whole world has to see it. So let's just decently expose myself to the whole freaking world. You know what I mean? So maybe he's perfectly... detained in the head. I don't know.
If you want to do that, become a porn star. You know, that's
yeah.
That's
then, you know, yeah, exactly. Like, in certain cases, you know, do that or whatever. But again, I don't want to see your dick ever in normal society. Okay, I just don't. I feel like the people that, like, I hope, anyways, that the people that, like, I've had sex with will never just, like, throw it out there for the whole world to see. You know, it's black people don't do that as much. I'm kidding. Yeah. I'm kidding. I'm sure they do. But yeah, it's just, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Sick. Anyways.
Yeah. Gross.
Let's move on to the next person, Dennis Lorty. So long before there was the 2014 Parliament Hill attacks, if I remember those, remember that particular attack, there was Dennis, I can't believe that was in 2014 though. It's a long time ago. There was Dennis Lorty. So using weapons stolen from a Canadian Armed Forces base, Lorty charged shooting into the Quebec National Assembly in 1984, wounding 13 and killing 3 government employees. And their names are George Beyer, Camille LePage, and Roger LaFrançais. The death toll could have easily been much higher, though, if the attack had started while the assembly was actually in session. Lorty pleaded guilty to 3 counts of second-degree murder in 1987, but got day parole. Check this shit. In 1995, so not even 15 years, and full parole in 96, which was only 12 years after the murders. I don't even know. I don't even know, ma'am.
Oh. Once again, this is Canada, right?
All of these were Canada, yeah.
No.
Yeah. So Canada's youngest mass murderer, and we don't have a name for her, but... if you are a true crime person, hopefully you recognize this particular crime. Maybe, Mikkel, you might have. I don't know. But this is one of the more, I hate to say famous, but more well-known cases here, especially in Canada, as well as a lot of people in the States know this particular case. Right. So She's only known by her initials in court documents because she was underage, which is JR. But she was 12 years old when she had her 23-year-old boyfriend, Jeremy Steinke, break into her Medicine Hat home to murder her parents. I'm not done. Her 8-year-old brother was also killed to prevent him from becoming a witness. Okay? JR was completely freed after 8.5 years in prison, with one judge saying that her murdered parents, quote, would be rather proud of her rehabilitation. Now,
8.5, hold on, eight and a half years.
Now, here's the thing. Because she was underage, the things are very different with people who are underage. 9 times out of 10, they are going to get out when they are legal age, which 18, right. 19, whatever. Yeah. They are going to get out. That's the case here. That's the case in the States as well.
So was it her and her boyfriend, or her boyfriend did all this?
I can't remember if she was there. There's, I think if I remember correctly, there is, we're not 100% certain if she was actually there when the murders happened. Even if she was, though, it wouldn't change anything. She was still gone now, early, in consideration. What? Because she was underage. That's why.
What is a 12-year-old dealing with a 20? I remember years
so here's when I was the thing. There's a lot more to this, to the case. Yeah. Obviously, I'm not getting into. Yeah, but this was a young girl who was very rebellious. Mm. She liked to listen to, like, quote unquote, devil music. Like, I don't think her family was necessarily
heavy metal stuff. Yeah.
I don't think her family was necessarily religious, but she was very much into all of that kind of stuff. And she's 12-year-old. She's 12 years old. She's very gullible or naive, or, you know, she's 12. She's 12 years old.
12 years old, yeah.
She is in this crowd of people, of friends, where Jeremy is also, Jeremy Steinke, who's the killer, he was also there too. He is a little bit of a slower learner. He is a person who seems to relate more to kids. And I think, if I remember correctly, it took him a while to graduate. Like, he was a mess himself, but he sees himself a lot, I think, younger than he actually is. And they have this friendship that eventually grows into something more. Like, if I remember, it's been a while since I've heard the story in full, but if I remember correctly, like, I think, like, he kills her parents. She stays with him in his trailer. And if I remember correctly, like, he had sex with her, but he raped her. Because that's what it is. Afterwards as well. Like, but, like, that's kind of how this happened. So yes, you do ask yourself, what is a 12-year-old doing with a 23-year-old? But again, it's just that case of the adult in the room doesn't know any better, and it's up to him to have known better than to get involved with a 12-year-old or anyone underage for that matter.
Well, I've seen this happen. Not the situation, but this crime, I've seen situations where, like, this type of relationship happens in elementary school.
Well, or even high school.
High school, like, elementary high school, I would say so. That, you know, a 12-year-old's into, like, older older guys that are in, like, 20s, and I'm like, I don't understand that. I'm like, what do you guys have in common?
You have anything in common. You don't have anything in common. Like,
I mean, perhaps a nice car, you know.
You're thinking in case in ways that it could be, but it's most likely not because of that.
Yeah,
but, like, it has nothing to do with that. As a woman who prefers to be with older men or whatever, and again, older men is still, like, within my age range. Like, that's, it's just, yeah, it's about the car, and it's sometimes for some people, but it's not always about that.
I mean, you're 12 years old, though. Like, what are you? You're not thinking about being with like an old. They're more mature. They're more older. Blah blah blah.
But that's exactly why. That's exactly why.
You think a 12-year-old thinks like
that?
Mm-hmm. Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Like, yes. Like again, you have to think about the fact of women mature a lot faster than boys do.
Really?
Okay. Right. That's a fact. Mm. We just do, and also on top of that, like you have to also remember. I mean, boys are going through puberty too, but women are going through puberty in a way that is drastically.
Yeah.
Difference, not just about getting the boobs and all that. It's we're also getting periods. Like it's just, it's completely different. And we do. If I think of myself as a 12-year-old, like I wouldn't have necessarily wanted to date guys my age. I mean, I wasn't dating at all, so it doesn't matter. But I wouldn't have necessarily wanted to date guys that I was going to school with because they were all immature. They were stupid. This. Like that's the case. Like you have to remember, we're thinking like that. I had friends that dated older guys, and I'll admit here, like this is a crime. I'm telling you this right now.
Yeah.
But when you're that age and you're in the moment, you don't think like that. I was 15, and I had men who lied to me about their ages, just enough. In order to have sex with me. And one of them stuck around for a long time until I realized, oh, this is a pattern for him. So, that's
crazy.
Yeah, I was 15. He was 24. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know. He told me he was 19. And then eventually, after we had sex the first time, is when he told me, but I lost my virginity to him. That's why he stuck around. So, this happens all the time.
Yeah, I know.
I can now be 32 and look at it from the outside looking in now and be like, he was a predator and I was his prey. And yeah, because again, I had another instance around the same time of a different guy when I was 15 telling me he was 18, but he was actually 25. And when I found out that truth from that, I lost my fucking mind. I actually lost my mind at him. And I'm like, are you kidding me? But the reason why he felt comfortable to tell me his age is because of the guy I lost my virginity to was a year younger than him. And I'm like, yeah, but the difference is I slept with him and I lost my virginity to him.
Right.
But again, I was still too young to realize both y'all are fucked up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing, though. At that age, even though when I knew the truth, you're still like, oh, this older guy, like, he's like, why would he ever want to be into me? But then, like, I think this thing started to shift for me when I was about, I think, 16, 17. And he's still very much a part of my life at that point. And he was like, oh, I see myself marrying you one day. And I'm like, what? And it was at that point that I'm like, that's never gonna happen. For many reasons, that's never gonna happen. And one of them being, you're 9 years older than me. Like, I started to clue in at that point. And yeah, it eventually ended. Like, once I was in college, and I think, like, kind of in college. I think it was in college, we weren't seeing much of each other, but we would still talk from time to time. By the time I was like fully employed somewhere, I'm like, that's the last time I talked to him. And that was about 21 years old. I haven't talked to him since. So I'm like, you preyed on me. And I see you're doing the same thing now to people who are at my school, who are currently at my high school. You're a predator.
So he
was in his 30s at that point.
So he was walking around looking for okay.
Mm-hmm.
And R. Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes me sick even knowing like I was a prey.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I know we went off topic there.
We did a little bit, but yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know why a 12-year-old is into 23.
I think you're asking the wrong question. Yeah. Why is a 23-year-old interested in anyone who's underage? You're asking the wrong question because it's not asking in that way makes it feel like you're victim blaming when really it's adult interested in
why are you interested? I just don't know, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
you just told me, so
there you go.
Okay,
so next person.
Yeah,
Michael Hirma, I think is how you say his name. On the night of Boxing Day in 1988, Yerima, who was 22, was among a group of men who pulled 21-year-old Terry Spindler out of a Kingston bar, bundled him off to a house, and proceeded to beat and torture him to death, ending the night by urinating on his body. Lovely. The men believe that Spindler had been the perpetrator of a violent robbery against a local drug dealer's mother. In fact, the robbery had been committed by Spindler's twin brother. So the victim's twin brother, not him. Hmm. Convicted of first-degree murder, Yerma was out of prison before his 40th birthday. So let's do the math here. That is 18 years. With the parole board saying he had shown remarkable change in his personality. The parents of Spindler did not attend Yerma's parole board hearings, telling local media through a friend that they didn't wish to participate in a process that they saw as being slanted against the victim. So, that's what they did. Vince Lee. Now, you may not recognize the name necessarily, but you are going to recognize the case. Although he now calls himself Will Baker, Lee was in the depths of untreated schizophrenia in 2008 when on a Greyhound bus in Manitoba, he stabbed suit mate Tim McLean to death and began mutilating and eating the corpse. Remember the story?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard about this story, yeah.
Yeah, this is one that I learned about in college during my psychology course. And I literally remember going into that class being like, I'm really hungry. I'm ready for lunch. And after this case was being discussed, I'm like, I'm sick. Because we go really in-depth in that class in terms of this case.
I think I heard about that in history class. I remember a certain teacher.
You couldn't have been, because this had only happened in 2012. You were out of high school at that point.
Out of high school? Really?
Yeah. This happened when I learned about it.
I heard a different incident.
You heard a different incident, but this particular case was after you were in high school. One of the first RCMP officers on the scene could actually later take his own life. I didn't know this. In part because of the trauma. Because here's the thing. He was left alone in this bus for hours with the corpse. And what he did to this man's body, his family couldn't even identify him because there was nothing left to identify. Let's put that in layman's terms. It was horrific what this man did to him. Baker was found not criminally responsible for this murder in 2017, and in 2017 was granted an absolute discharge from psychiatric care, effectively removing any ability for the justice system to monitor him, its movements, and his actions. Karen DeVelli, who was McLean's mother, the victim's mother, vigorously opposed the release. I remember she was just trying to do everything she could to change this verdict, saying there was no way to ensure that Baker wouldn't forsake his medication and kill again. She said, quote, "I don't believe for one second that Will Baker poses no threat." And I agree. Mm-hmm. I 100% agree. I was terrified that this man would actually be released again. And he was. Now, I'm not trying to take away from the fact that he was mentally ill.
Yeah.
But if he had medication and chose to not take his medication, that's a choice. And that same goes for the woman who stabbed the other woman in Shoppers Drug Mart in Toronto.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. That one.
Mm-hmm. That is another case of someone who's mentally ill and chose to not take her medication and walked into a Shoppers Drug Mart and killed this woman. And the thing is, it's like, she's out, by the way. She's free. And they had an episode of Crime Beat about this after she was released. And when you hear the things that she did and you see, as a person who works in Toronto, can you see where she is? She's in the Starbucks across the way from the Shoppers. She goes into the Shoppers and she didn't have a job. That's the scarier part of it, is that she wasn't actually working. She was just going to the Starbucks that, by the way, is steps away from where I currently work, and just sitting there, and walks into the Shoppers that I have frequented many times, especially in the last 7 years. And there's not a time that I, because again, where I enter 9 times out of 10 to go into the Shoppers Drug Mart again, if you are a person who works in Toronto, who knows the TD tower quite well, you know, like, I'm entering through the cosmetic section. And there is not a time that I don't enter into the cosmetic section and have to go into the exact aisle that this poor woman was murdered, and potentially even in the same spot. Like, I think she was a little further back from the opening, but she literally, I'm in the same spot that poor woman was murdered. And there's not a time that goes by that I don't think about her. And the fact this woman is out free boggles my mind, because it's like, okay, I understand you're mentally ill, but I also understand you chose to stop taking your medication. And that's the part that I have an issue with, because you could do that all over again.
So, yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Let's move on to the next person. Stephen Comerfield. So in 1995, the 20-year-old Comerfield and a friend got extremely drunk, cruised the streets of Regina looking for a prostitute, and then took her to a remote area where they decided to beat her to death. According to a later autopsy, Pamela Jean George, she was 28 years old and a mother of two. It was still clinging to life when they left her face down in a field near the Regina airport. I'm not sure who this is saying. It's like, it's him. They said, "We drove around, got drunk, and killed this chick." And this is what Comerfield said. And he apparently was a university basketball star and the grandson of the Saskatchewan cabinet minister.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he ended up telling a friend, was that he drove around and killed a girl. He told this to a friend the next day, according to court testimony. So he was convicted of manslaughter. Are you kidding?
Wow.
I don't understand that. But he was convicted of manslaughter. Comerfield was granted full parole only 5 years after the crime. 5
Wow, 5 years.
A parole board decision wrote that Cumberfield showed little remorse for his crime. Okay. Remorse. Let me say this again. They wrote that he showed little remorse for his crime.
Little remorse?
Little, like none.
Basically. I thought they said remorse.
No.
I'm
no,
like,
no.
Okay, I none. I've seen
none.
Wow.
And that's and the then thing is him... like and they gave him parole. Because that's the thing. You're supposed to show remorse and admit to, yeah, I did this. Not the requirements of parole. And yet this fucker doesn't and is granted parole. What the hell is happening?
His lawyer must have been really good. I want to know his lawyer.
His lawyer was probably really good. But because he was a grandson of a cabinet minister, that helped okay, in I his see. Favor. No. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm.
All right. They had a little money exchange behind the yeah. scenes. And just like, yes,
most likely. Yeah. So yeah, they said because he may have not showed any remorse, but regardless of that, he wasn't quote an undue risk on full parole.
That's crazy.
Anyway, next, and again, I don't know if you'll know the story, but I right. do recognize the story as well. I've seen quite a bit of on this
mm-hmm.
Calgary girl named Kimberly Thompson, cutest little thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was snatched off of the street by someone by the name of Smeltzer. This is his last name. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch the first name, guys. Sorry about that. But she was snatched by him in 1980 while she was on her way to kindergarten. Okay, this is a trigger warning for this right. pretty horrific, and this is about the child. Okay, he drowned her in a bathtub and stuffed her body in a garbage can. Whew, only 5 years old at the time, Kimberly would now be 44, had she lived. In addition to the murder, Smeltzer also admitted to 40 other sexual assaults against children. This guy is a pedophile.
Mm.
The Parole Board of Canada began granting this disgusting fuck unescorted passes in 2008. So you think that this man is capable of not reoffending? At the very least, not try and sexually assault children? Like I said, put him under the fucking jail. And let him rot.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense to me, but...
Yeah, I just have no answers for that, because anybody that assaults children...
Oh, I don't care what happens to you. I could care less.
I think you deserve life in prison.
I think you deserve the death penalty, honestly.
Everything that's coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Let's get round done yet, because despite numerous parole violations, such as... Buckle up, guys. Such as possessing pornography or admitting to being attracted to young girls while on day parole, and this is also in Regina.
Wow.
Those things, the leaves, the day parole has continued. Quote, "It makes me sick, actually. Sick to my stomach because I'm so afraid that it's going to happen again to somebody else, and nobody should have to go through what our family has gone through." And this was said by Kim's mother, Evelyn Thompson, back in 2017. I don't even understand. I didn't know he was going to date parole. It's freaking ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you can't cure someone who's a pedophile. I'm sorry, you can't. You can try to convince me, but you're not going to.
Right.
So, next person, John Martin Crawford. So just before Christmas 1981, a 19-year-old Crawford beat Mary Jane Sirloin to death on the streets of Lethbridge, Alberta. I'm like, where's that? Alberta. A subsequent autopsy found bite marks all over Stormwind's body that were consistent with Crawford's dental profile. Now, I know dental stuff is considered junk science, but I'm sorry. If your teeth match, they match. Crawford was convicted of manslaughter and was out of prison within 10 years. Soon after his release, though, he began killing again. Okay? Wow. He began killing again. And in 1995, Crawford was charged in the murders of three missing Indigenous women. And their names are Shelley Napope, who was 16, Eva Tysup, who was 30, and Kalinda Waterhen, who was 22. The skeletons of all three were found in shallow graves at a Saskatoon area golf course. Guy's sick. Next person, Georgia Lovey. In 1991, Lovey allegedly sexually assaulted a former girlfriend at knife point, telling her that if she went to police about the crime, he would kill her family. However, she did go to police. And like he promised, 6 weeks later, he responded by brutally murdering her parents, Arnold and Donna Edwards, in front of her. Former Buffalo Sabres goalie Don Edwards is the son of Arnold and Donna, and was a target of similar threats from Lovey as well. The murders made Edwards a public advocate for stricter homicide sentencing, although his efforts met with little success. In 2017, Lovey began receiving unescorted absences into downtown Sudbury. Quote, to think this guy is going to be walking the streets of Sudbury and people don't know who he is or what he's all about. I'll be honest, I'm completely pissed off. It's one of the reasons I left Canada. Amen to that. And this was said by Edwards, the Buffalo Sabres guy, who now lives in an undisclosed part of the U.S. for security reasons. Mm-hmm. Okay, Penny Boudreau. In 2008, Boudreau drove her 12-year-old daughter, Carissa, to an isolated area outside Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, ordered her to leave the car, and then strangled her to death with a piece of twine. I'm not gonna tell you what Carissa's last words were, but let's just say heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking. You can probably find out if you really want to know, but just it's heartbreaking. Boudreau then falsely claimed that Carissa had been abducted and put out a tearful public plea for her return. Although convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 20 years in prison, in June, the Parole Board of Canada began granting Boudreau escorted leaves from prison to attend church. God doesn't love you, my girl. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just putting it out there. This case actually very much reminded me of Diane Downs. Again, if you are a true crime person, you know the name Diane Downs. Very much reminded me of that. Very similar. Where she drove her kids out to a remote area, shot all three of them. One did die. And the other two survived. And she also was like, oh, someone came and just shot my kids. This, I think she said it was a black man too, which is, we can talk about really? That, but oh yeah. People who try to be like, it's, I don't know if you've watched the story is on Netflix right now. Okay, what Jennifer did. What Jennifer, there's a story called What Jennifer Did or whatever. I think it's basically what it's called. It's about the story of, I don't know if you know the story of the girl in Markham, Asian girl who had her, or had her, tried to have both her parents murdered, but the father did survive. It's a very well-known story, but they finally did something, documentary on Netflix, and it's huge at the moment. And same thing, she would say, oh yeah, like, these people came into the house and they tied me up and they shot my parents. And when she described them, this was in 2012, okay? So not much has changed. This was in 2012. And she's like, yeah, they were black men. One had dreads, the other one didn't. And I think they had Jamaican accents. Are you kidding? We can talk about that too. Kaboom's like, are you kidding? Like, why are you targeting not only Black people, but then you're in this case targeting Jamaican people? Fuck you, bitch. Like, I'm not gonna get into the story. If you want to know, there's a documentary on Netflix if you want to watch it. Yeah. But it's just, it's one of those things, man. Anyway,
crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're done with those cases, but I did, as I mentioned, want to talk about a story that's more personal for me. And Mikhail, you probably know once I get into what I'm talking about because you were around when this happened. So I had someone, a part of my family, who he was my cousin's boyfriend, and they had kids. She's also my godmom. And this happened in 2012, and he was at work minding his own business. He was a barber. This was in Melbourne. Again, I think as I start talking, some people might recognize the story too if you live in this province. And he was shot and killed in front of people, in front of customers in his barber shop that he was working in. I'm not gonna say his name, but again, if you know, you know. And I can say, as a person who, I'm not gonna cry, this was a person who, his smile would literally light up a room. I know people say that all the time, but he would. And I knew him for the better part of my life. Like, he'd been a person that was in, that I've known since I was a child. And it was absolutely heartbreaking when this news came out. I remember I was in college, and I remember my mom coming home in tears, and when she said he died, and she used his name obviously, and the crazy thing is when she said his name is that we actually have more than one family member with his name. So I wasn't sure who she was talking about. She was talking about my uncle, or she was talking about my cousin who was actually this man's child, or him. I didn't know who she was talking about. But when she told me, I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I'm going to talk about kind of what happened and how and what the sentencing was eventually, but we'll get to it. And when I turned on the news and I saw what happened, I it didn't hit me right away, because I've never experienced someone being murdered in my family before or since. And it didn't hit me until the next day when I was at school in my psychology class, actually. And literally, my friend knew. I had a friend, a close friend in college, who didn't know what was going on. And I remember just being in class saying, I can't do this. And I literally had to leave. I think actually I left, and I either went home or went to see you. I can't remember. But I remember just being like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And
I understand.
I was an absolute mess. And I think my friend did end up telling professors and everything, like, what was going on and why it wasn't there. Because I'm like, I just can't. I can't. This is the last thing I need to be hearing right now. It was absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
But what was even more devastating is kind of when you find out why, it's angering. And then when I found out what he was charged, what the people were charged with, or person, I'll get to it. I'm like, you can't be serious. So let's get to it. So, a 28-year-old man pleaded guilty to second-degree murder of the slaying of a popular, and when I mean popular, I mean popular, barber from Toronto's Melford neighborhood. second degree murder. Now, what is not in this article, but I'm going to tell you, because when they had the funeral, you can cover things up as much as you can, but you can't cover up the gunshot wound that was in his head. They made him kneel. This person made him kneel like an animal and shot him in the head. It's not in the article, but that is what happened. And I just don't understand how this person was charged with second degree murder. I don't get it. I just don't. But again, I'm not using his name, but he was 35 years old. He had two kids. My cousins, he had two kids. And one of them was very young. I'm thinking 2012. She's the same age as my brother. So I'm going to say 9. Yeah, 9 years old when he died. So yeah, he was shot to death. This was in January of 2012. Mm-hmm. In the barbershop that is attached to Malvern Town Center. And that is, it may not be in this article either, but that is significant, and I'll tell you why in a minute. The person who killed him, his name is Kevin Perez, entered the guilty plea, admitting he pulled the trigger on the shotgun and killed him after the barber pulled out of a $300 deal. I'm going to talk about that in a minute as well. Mm. So that is what he did. He said, quote, "He didn't do nothing to that guy." And this was said by his brother, the victim's brother. He said, "My brother got killed for what? $300. We're going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about it. Don't worry." Mm-hmm. In court, Perez said it all started with a dispute over stolen computers. So the victim had planned to buy some computers. I don't believe it's believed that he did not know the computers were stolen, but he was planning to buy 2 laptops. Okay. 2 of them. And they were going to be $300. And I'm telling you this because one laptop was going to be for him, for his use. The other laptop was going to be for his son, my cousin. That was what was going on. But what ended up happening was one of the laptops was actually broken, and the victim backed out of the deal because of it. Mm. Okay. Perez showed up with a shotgun. This would have been, I think, like a week later. Okay, this was all very quick. Perez showed up with a shotgun, planning to intimidate the victim. He ended up shooting him, firing over and over as he tried to get away. So it's the reason why I say, like, I just don't understand how this person was charged with second degree murder is because there was video surveillance of the person in the mall going back and forth. You could see him for the longest time going back and forth in the mall. And clearly this person was contemplating what he's about to do, because the barbershop is just like toward the back of the mall. So he eventually goes into the barbershop, as said. And like I said, he says that he was there to intimidate him at his place of work, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
He's there to intimidate him. But that doesn't make sense, because you told this man to kneel, to get on his knees in order to do what you wanted to do. And I believe people I think a lot of people did talk a lot. Yes, this was a person who was dear to the community, but we're also talking about the fear, right? This is Malvern. Malvern is not a safe place. Mm-hmm. But from people who did speak up, that's not at all what happened. He wasn't trying to intimidate him. That's three you want to lead with, that's fine. But you stole someone away from his kids.
Mm.
My god, mom. You stole him. You took him away. His daughter is now 20. Shoot, how old my brother? 21? 20. She's going to be 21 next month, actually. And he doesn't get to also see his son, who's also a father now himself. This is this ricochet effect when people do what they do.
Yeah.
He's a grandfather, and they've never met their grandpa because of something that this asshole did. It's just ridiculous. But there's a little more to this. There's a little bit more that I also want to talk about, which I didn't know about this. He wasn't alone that day. His brother was also there. And they were initially, this is why I'm shocked by this, because I didn't know this. They were initially charged with first degree murder, but was later withdrawn. And the reason why the brother wasn't charged with anything was because, well, he didn't actually commit the murder. He was in the car. He was supposed to be like the getaway person. But we're supposed to believe that the brother didn't know what was about to happen. And I don't buy that for a minute. I do believe the brother knew what was about to happen. But yeah, I guess there's something you can do about that if he's saying he didn't know. I don't know. The police did say that the man going to prison is the only one responsible for the slaying. They said, quote, "We know we have the right person who committed this crime against the person that I'm not saying his name." And this was said by Toronto Police Detective Leslie Dunkley. Perez is serving a 20-year sentence. Now, the part that is, as I've mentioned in previous cases, 20 years doesn't mean 20 years, and 20 years means he is going to be free, and he is going to be able to live a life, and he was only 28 when he went into prison, so he's going to come out and be 40, late 40s, into his 50s.
Yeah.
And he'll get to live a life, where meanwhile our family member who was brutally murdered doesn't. This is why the system needs to change. Is we're talking, this happened 12 years ago, and it's still, it's something that I never looked at, probably for self-preserving reasons, but it's something that I did for this case, because I thought, you know what, I need to show how this can affect people who are who have to deal with something like this. And this is why the system needs to change. Because intimidating somebody, and maybe accidentally the gun goes off. He was a tall man, and it could have maybe shot him in the arm or the leg or something that wouldn't have been it, wouldn't have been so final. That's not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
He shot him in the place of a body that would have deemed him dead. He died on scene. He was pronounced dead on the scene. I'm sorry, but that's just, none of this makes sense to me.
Yeah. Just senseless violence that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Over 300.
$300.
$300.
A laptop because it was broken. That's all this was about. Yeah.
And Sarah's 20 years.
20 years. For the brutal death of someone. Yeah.
Wow. Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was, it was a very trying time for my family at the time, for sure. You know, it's a trying time when you have certain family members who don't attend family, and I'm not going to say who, but who don't attend family gatherings at all, who didn't even know him, actually didn't know him personally. My uncle, who actually went by the same name, he showed up at the funeral too, and his funeral was packed. There were people, they had to live where they did it. They had to do it there because they knew the amount of people who would show up would have been just so many people. I think it was like hundreds of people showed up at the funeral. Hundreds. People were standing. And, you know, even a restaurant here in Ajax, actually they do have one in Pickering too. Barrel's Pepper Pot catered the gathering after the funeral for free, because he left an impression on them too, because he would actually travel from Scarborough to Ajax to pick food up because he loved the food so much. So they catered the funeral after, and it's just again, there was things I didn't know that I knew certain things, obviously, when it first came about, like when they found the person, they caught him and all that. I knew all of that. We talked about things, but I didn't know anything else beyond that until now. And I cried. I was very upset.
Yeah. I was just supposed to. Yeah.
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 But yeah, before we end this off, though, I do want to talk about something very quickly, that is kind of true crime related. OJ Simpson has finally had his comeuppance, because he's now dead. Now, does that mean I might go to hell because I'm happy that Stan is dead? Potentially. But you know what? That's the risk I'm willing to take. He's now dead. He died of prostate cancer. The perfect way for him to go. Torturous. Mm-hmm. Anyways. Problem that I'm having right now is that I've seen on like CTV news or whatever. Mm-hmm. Facebook even. Basically talking about his accomplishments and the life of O.J. Simpson. I don't give flying rat's ass about his accomplishments and all of this. No, I don't give a shit. This man killed his wife and her acquaintance, who he thought it was more than that.
See, I think what the news is trying to do is they do it for everybody who, like, you know, dies. They focus on the accomplishments, and I understand, like, I think a lot of news outlets do think that, as well as that, what they hear from the verdict, that there was, like, you know, no proof of that he killed his wife. So focus on the positive.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But when it's pretty clear, let's be real here, he killed her. And the friend, Ron Goldman, he killed them. I don't care. And I think that is the consensus with a lot of people. And when you come out with a quote-unquote hello book of if I did it, then sorry, like, did it.
Yeah, if I did it, this is how I would do it.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow.
He was quote-unquote acquitted of his crime. But he still did it. He did it. And that's the part that when I found out he was... First of all, when I found out he died, I'm like, is that a joke?
And yeah, that's the first thing I saw.
But the first thing I saw, I'm like, this is a joke, yeah, right? Because the man just got out of prison. I'm like, this is a joke. Mm-hmm. And then when I... Because usually in those cases, I won't just rely on Facebook. I'll do a Google search. So I did the Google search and I saw, yeah, he's dead. And I'm like, I was actually sitting on the couch. My mom's in the kitchen. And I started giggling. I started giggling for real. And I was like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, OJ Simpson's dead. She's like, oh, come on. And I'm like, I'm going to hell. And that's okay. Because I'm laughing at the fact that this man's dead. I don't care. I feel nothing that this man is dead. And maybe, again, that makes me horrible. Mm. When I'm talking about O.J. Simpson, yeah. I don't care. I'll feel I'm a horrible person then.
Well, there have been, like, reports, like, months ago that he was going to the hospital frequently.
Mm-hmm.
But he came out and, you know, denied it. And said,
yeah, like, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and people were saying that he's a liar, da, 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 all that stuff.
Because he is a liar.
Then connecting that to his cases too. So like saying that he's a liar, you lied about, you know, going to the hospital. You're also a liar of murdering somebody.
What I'll say. That's kind of mincing at the same time. Yes, O.J. Simpson's a liar.
Yeah.
But he doesn't owe anybody anything to talk about his diagnosis mm-hmm. if he doesn't want to. Mm-hmm. So, I hate to compare these two people, but I'm just in the case of the illness of the cancer. And that is it. Are we going to call Chadwick Boseman a liar because he didn't tell anybody he had cancer? No.
Mm.
So he has the right to keep it to himself if he so chooses. But eventually it's going to come out when you're dead. And dead. And I'm going to think, oh well, enjoy hell. Because that's where you're headed. Oh, right. I'm ecstatic personally. I don't care. I've never been happy about someone's death until O.J. Simpson. And even Charlie Manson, I'm like, well, he was in prison, so who cares? He served time.
Mm-hmm.
This was perfect. I'm like, I've never been so happy. It's fine, but it is what it is. The other part to this that I want to quickly talk on is apparently his will, which was filed with Cassidy Law Offices.
Yeah.
The person who is the executor of the will,
mm-hmm.
and his name is Malcolm LaVerge, I believe, basically said that any money that is owing, which is most of it, to Ron Goldman's family, isn't gonna get a dime. This is what he's saying. He says, quote, "It's my hope that the Goldmans get zero. Nothing."
That's what he said in the will?
That's what he said to reporters or something
mm-hmm.
about the will. This is the executor. He said, only them. He's only targeting them for some reason. And he says, "I will do everything in my capacity as the executor or personal representative to try and ensure that they get nothing." And he actually cited the events surrounding O.J. Simpson's book, If I Did It, in which the family secured the rights and later issued a revised edition featuring additional commentary. So I guess he's basically trying to say is well, they have that book, so they got anything from the sales of that book. But that's nowhere near the amount of what is owed to them. So for this asshole to literally say they're getting nothing.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you are the executor. It is your job to ensure that whatever needs to be done when it comes to his estate is done, including paying the people he murdered. Then you do it. And you shut the fuck up and you do what you're supposed to do as the executor.
Mm.
So you're on my hit list too, sir. I'm just saying. But yeah, I'm when I read this, I'm like, you can't be serious.
Wow.
Least O.J. Simpson's estate could do is pay the victims' families for what he did to them. It's the least he could do.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Okay.
That's it.
this ends episode 30 of the Next Tape Podcast. The Next Tape Podcast is available now on all podcast platforms. We also have a website called solo.tl/Next Tape Podcast. Where else are we at, Tanika?
Okay, I'm also rusty. Give it a minute. So we are on Facebook and Instagram at Next Tape Podcast and Twitter and TikTok at Next Tape Pod. Why did it?
Okay, we also have a email. So contact us at mikaeltanika@gmail.com. So that's mikaeltanika@gmail.com. So we're both rusty. So we talked about a lot of things. We also had Tristan with us earlier onto this episode. We talked about a lot of things that involves like crime. What else do we talk about?
The main thing we talked about was the Canadian justice system, whether or not it potentially needs any improvements, which I think we landed on. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay. Shout outs to Tristan. What's his podcast, Tanika, once again, so the people can
know? Right. So the murder, it's called A Murder Without End. So you can get it on any of your podcast platforms. And again, I've highly recommended it in the previous episodes, but I'm going to continue doing that. It's a very different podcast. Yes, it's focused on the crime, but it also focuses on the legal side of things. In this particular case. So it's really well done. It's a really good podcast and definitely recommend.
Yeah, we'll check it out. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other streaming services. So like, that's about it. So that's like, anything else you want to tell the people before we go? Can you go? That's it.
No, I don't that's think it? So.
All right. Oh, another thing is that we are at 4,000 downloads, by the way. 4,000 on this podcast. So thank you for listening to us.
Thank you.
We didn't expect that much to be listening in the last, like, what, seven months now?
Close to that. We started in September.
September?
Yeah.
Pretty much 7-8 months. But yeah. We appreciate you guys for listening to the podcast. Hopefully you guys continue to listen to this podcast because we got more conversations, more topics. More,
oh, we do. Definitely do.
Coming to this podcast. So, thank you. All right. So I'm Mikael and.
And I'm Tanika.
We are out until next week. Peace, everybody.
Bye.